It's wonderful to see so many people here this evening, a spectacular turnout, and quite reasonably so. Each year, the Pontifical Faculty of the Immaculate Conception hosts a lecture adjacent to the Feast of St. Thomas Aquinas in honor of this patron of the Dominican Order and in view of the advancement of Thomistic studies. This year, we are especially honored to host a senior figure in contemporary American philosophy and theology, Monsignor Robert Sokolowski. A member of the School of Philosophy at the Catholic University of America, now he had told me tonight dinner for 50 years, which is an amazing accomplishment for a professor. Monsignor Sokolowski has written, at least by my count, at least 10 books and over 100 scholarly articles. He is renowned as an expert interpreter of Edmund Husserl and of the phenomenological philosophical tradition. He's also well known as a person who places that tradition squarely into conversation with the philosophical ontology of Aristotle and Aquinas. Among his most well-known works are his Introduction to Phenomenology from the year 2000, which has been translated into 7 languages, and his Phenomenology of the Human Person from 2008, as well as his frequently discussed book, The God of Faith and Reason, Foundations of Christian Theology, first published in 1982. Monsignor Sokolowski has published essays and books on a lot of subjects: language, ontology, the incarnation, Eucharistic theology, art, natural law. When I asked him about 8 months ago what he would like to speak on for this event, he said succinctly, the issue of the truth. How perfectly appropriate in a Dominican House of Studies whose motto is itself Veritas, and it fittingly serves to honor the patron of this lecture as well. The topic of the talk this evening is the truth of things in pictures and words. Please help me welcome Monsignor Sokolowski.
Thank you, Father Thomas Joseph, and I'm grateful for the invitation to speak here in this series of Thomistic circles and to honor St. Thomas Aquinas during this week. The central theme of my discussion will be words, that is, speech and language, and I will try to show how words are related to things and how words contain meanings. I will try to show, to use a term I'd like to introduce, I will try to show how words capture and carry the intelligibility of things. To put this in more traditional terminology, I will try to discuss the identity theory of knowledge, which is generally agreed to be an Aristotelian and scholastic doctrine, and which claims that what we know and name are the things themselves. I will try to show how things enter into cognitional existence, but I will show how such cognitional existence can best be clarified as an existence not simply in the intellect or senses, but also in the words that we speak, the words that are part of our language. Speech, language, and words make up a central component in the issue of truth. So this topic has wide-ranging philosophical implications and even metaphysical ones, and certainly political ones as well, as Plato's running controversy with the sophists has shown. I might also add that Plato's and Aristotle's arguments with the sophists was not just a historical incident that occurred long ago. The substance of that issue is with us now and will be with us always. In trying to clarify the being and activity of words, I will also comment about the being and activity of pictures. And I will claim that things take up a cognitional existence in images as well as in words, and that real pictures and statues can house the cognitional being of things as well as the phantasms that enter into human and animal knowing. So what I'm going to do is try to explore this issue on its own terms and to make a philosophical contribution. You might even say a metaphysical one. But I'd also like to use this as a kind of historical clarification. I would like to use these ideas and themes to recover ancient philosophy, but to do so in a new key, in a way that overcomes a modern predicament. Because I think the issues being talked about are part of the problem that arose with modernity when metaphysics shifted into a kind of mode that detaches us from the knowledge of things. So I've got a polemical undertone to my paper as well. To show this relevance to modern philosophy and to show what I'd like to overcome in it, may I recall the fact that the major political works of Thomas Hobbes all begin with epistemological or cognitional considerations. He starts with them all the time, so they're not irrelevant to his political philosophy. The Elements of Law, the De Cive, and the Leviathan all have several pages at their beginnings about how we experience things and how we name them. And in all these works, Hobbes takes great pains to show that the appearances of things are disconnected, even spatially disconnected, from the things themselves. The separation of words from things is essential to Hobbes's political philosophy and to politics in modernity. So there's not only a metaphysical issue here, but a political philosophical one as well. In fact, in Hobbes, representation as normative, not presentation, but representation is essential to both his political philosophy and to the epistemology that he instances, and indeed, I think, for modern thought generally. So this issue of presentation, appearances, and representation is not just an epistemological problem, but a political one as well. This dislocation of appearances, separating them from the thing that appears, is vividly brought out in a passage in Hobbes's The Elements of Law. He writes in his forceful and elementary prose, quote, "Every man hath so much experience as to have seen the sun and other visible objects by reflection in the water and in glasses, and this alone is sufficient for this conclusion, that color and image may be there where the thing seen is not." End of quote. So the appearance is not in the thing, but elsewhere. There's a spatial displacement in modern epistemology. And when the appearance is so separated, it becomes what Hobbes has called, quote, "a thing merely fantastical." Hobbes refers to this shell game that nature plays on us as, quote, "the great deception of sense." We start off being deceived. In Leviathan, while discussing the kingdom of darkness, i.e. the Catholic Church, he writes, quote, "The fantastical forms, apparitions, or seeming of visible objects are nothing real in the thing seen, nor in the place where they seem to be." He is not saying that the appearances might on occasion be spatially separated from the things that appear. He claims that they never are to be found in the thing and cannot be located there because they are the outcome of a bodily motion that has departed from the object and found its residence in some reflecting surface. Hobbes then uses this paradigm of mirrors and mirroring to claim that our own sensibility functions in this same dislocating manner. He insists that the ideas in our sensibility are what we see, not the things themselves. And the upshot of this theory of experience is that the intelligibility of things is also not in the words that we use. In our day and age, we would say that what we know are the images in our brains, from which we reconstruct the things that have caused them, but that are located somewhere else. Now, if we want a thumbnail sketch of what phenomenology is, I think we could say that the doctrine of intentionality introduced by Husserl reverses precisely this Hobbesian claim. Phenomenology introduces a spatial correction to this theory of appearances. It places appearances in the things themselves. We do not go from appearances to things. Rather, we see things in their appearances. This slight adjustment, this simple change of prepositions, is a great challenge to modernity, and it allows us to recover not just ancient and medieval philosophy, but philosophy as such, the perennial philosophy. So that's the polemical side of my talk. I want to argue against that approach, of that Hobbesian and Lockean and Humean approach. I want to spell out this contribution that phenomenology can make and examine it in detail. And I intend to intend not just to tell you about it or tell you that it has occurred, nor will I just tell you about the ideas of other philosophers. I'll try to carry it out in person as we discuss words, pictures, and the truths of things. So that's the introduction of what I'd like to do in the time that follows. Now I come to the largest part of my talk. This will be the main section. And it could be entitled The Three Forms of Representation, Three Different Forms of Representation. And when I conclude with that, then I'll spell out a kind of conclusion for a few pages. So this is the bulk of my talk. It's one thing to perceive an object when it's presented and not represented. So when we actually encounter a thing and it's given to us, to have it given to us, and it's so what I want to focus on now in this long section is what happens in representation, where we don't have the object given, but rather some sorts of representation of it. Representations come in different forms, and I want to consider the following three. And my paper will be a kind of interplay of these three forms of representations. They are mirrors. I start with mirrors. Secondly, pictures. And finally, names. So we move from mirrors to pictures to names. And let's begin with the mirror then. Mirrored images are different from perceived things, but they're very close to them. Suppose we're standing near the corner of a building. We hold up a mirror in order to see what's around the corner, and then we practically perceive what's there. We see it in its ongoing behavior. We can identify the thing, see it coming closer, and see whether it's threatening or not. A mirrored image is like an annex to a perception. We react to it almost as we would react to the thing perceived. And yet, despite this affinity, the mirrored thing is somehow not the same as the perceived thing. True, it is identifiable as being the same particular item. It remains this automobile, this tree, or this man, but it is different in its mode of appearing. In mirroring, the thing appears in the mirror, whether glass, metal, or surface of water, and such a presence is different from appearing in itself when it is perceived. The spatial locations differ, as Hobbes knew. A mirror seems able, almost miraculously, to capture the appearance of a thing, and to take it some distance away and situate it somewhere else, even while maintaining a thread or a line between the displaced image and the thing whose image it is. Appearances can be detached in this way from the thing that appears. To recall the words of Hobbes, the appearance can be there where the thing that appears is not. We can even, so to speak, hold the appearance of a thing in the palm of our hand when we hold the mirror there. An identity can be achieved in this distinctive kind of difference. The thing itself does show up in these displaced appearances. Inserting a mirror into our field of perception is like introducing a new fourth dimension into our normal three-dimensional space. And mirroring does not just occur when we simply look at something in its reflection. It also functions dynamically as we interact with the world in which we are perceptually engaged. Consider how the representations in the three rear view mirrors of an automobile are woven into the activity of driving a car. We could not drive without such imaging. We need to look backward as well as forward as we drive, and we must be able to turn from the thing as reflected to the thing as seen. When a car that has been coming up fast overtakes us and passes on our left, the car we saw in the mirrors is now presented itself. It's a nice example that Plato could not have appreciated. And an identity is achieved. See, the thing to notice is not so much that we go from a mirror to the thing, but that it's the same thing. The identity is achieved in that transition. When we're driving, we don't pay attention to it unless you're a philosopher. And then you have to be very careful when you drive. You get caught up in the identity and the reflection on it. I mean, that's what interests you. As the car passes, it identifies itself as being the same and other, the classical duality of classical metaphysics. It asserts its identity. So we don't just contemplate things through mirrors, we engage with them. Think what happens when you're shaving or think of what a dentist or a dental technician does through mirrors. They're interacting with the thing and the image and the back to the thing again. Quite a marvelous case of identity and difference. Now, you must have noticed that I've been speaking as a philosopher, as someone who is talking not just about things, but about the manifestation of things. I have been speaking about appearances and the things that appear in them, and about some of the differences, identities, and changes that can occur among appearances. I have therefore shifted or modified the normal meaning of many of the words I use, such as capture, carry, location, situate, thread, in, and of. I've given them a philosophical meaning. They have a normal meaning, but I've troped them into philosophy. I'm not using language carelessly when I trope words this way. Our natural language must be adjusted when we move from ordinary discourse to the philosophical, when we turn from speaking about things to speaking about their manifestation and being. I will from time to time make further comments about the peculiarities of such metaphysical speech in order to show that what I am saying is not, quote, frivolous and childish, nugatorium et puerile, as Hobbes claims it to be. He had no interest in metaphysical discourse. Those are adjectives, pejorative adjectives he uses for that. And so I maintain that I'm not using words in a confused or absurd manner when I trope them into philosophy, and I'm not speaking loosely either. May also observe that my philosophical description does not obliterate the difference between the thing mirrored and the thing perceived, a distinction that's already at work in our pre-philosophical encounters with things. The thing is the same, the car that comes by and we identify it again. However, but being mirrored and being perceived are different. And you philosophically, it's very helpful to think about the thing within that difference of being mirrored and then being perceived. And then, of course, being named and being pictured and being remembered. You have all those other modifications of perception as well that one can think about. Incidentally, I think that this kind of exploration, which is obviously the kind that Husserl does and in phenomenology others also, is really an exploration of what Aristotle, one of the meanings of being that Aristotle talks about in Metaphysics Epsilon Chapter 2. He's got four senses of being, and the second is being as the true. You know that Brentano wrote a dissertation on that, which then became an important book. And Husserl was highly influenced by Brentano, so was Heidegger by that very book, in which the four senses of being form the four chapters of Brentano's book. And there are passages in Husserl himself where he refers to on hos aletheis, in the Greek, being as the true. So that he's exploring that aspect of traditional metaphysics. And so I'm drawing on that strain in his thought in developing these ideas and applying them then to perception and mirroring so far. Now, we'll go beyond mirroring right now. Suppose I use a mirror to watch someone who is around the corner from me. Suppose the person in question is Vladimir Putin. I want to see what he's up to. But then, suppose I tire of watching him through the mirror and turn instead to a picture of him. I turn to a small painting of him, which I happen to have with me. Instead of holding up the mirror, I hold up the painting and look at it. What or whom do I see? I still see Vladimir Putin, the same individual that I saw in the mirror and that I could see directly if I poked my head around the corner of the building, but now I see him in a picture and no longer in a mirror. How is this painting different from the mirror? Both are representations, and so they differ from a direct perception, but how do they differ? One point of difference is that a third person, a painter, comes between Vladimir Putin and me, and this painter has composed the painting. He has put it together. The painting is a deliberate composition, whereas the mirrored image is not. No one comes between me and the target when I see something in a mirror. Because of what the artist has done, and because I can take things as images, Vladimir Putin is identifiably there in the picture. I don't see something that looks like Putin. I see Putin pictorially. And it's a different kind of intentionality. It's a pictorial intentionality. Other things are there in the picture as well, but they too are present because they have been put there by the painter. Putin may never have worn the blue suit he's depicted as wearing. I mean, he may never have worn a carnation in his lapel as he does in the image. He's presented against a fanciful Russian landscape in the picture. Also placed in the picture along the edges are some important figures from Russian history. Ivan the Terrible. Peter the Great, Catherine the Great, and V.I. Lenin. All these things help to present not just Putin, but the significance of Putin. Both he and his meaning, or his essence, are attested and asserted by the picture in a way that does not occur in the mirror. The painting presents Putin not as he is now, but as he can be thought to be. The picture shows us how Putin can and perhaps should be seen and understood. The mirror may give us a lot of accidental information about Putin here and now. It tells us what he happens to be doing, But the painting gives us more about his essentials, about what he is, which is shown by what he has done and is thought to be capable of doing. The mirror does not give me an understanding. It does not exhibit the heightened meaning of Putin, but the painting does. The painting is like a speech about Putin made by the painter, while the mirror is more like a journalistic report. The mirror merely traces Putin, while the painting testifies about him. And a testimony calls for someone by whom it is made. In this case, the testifier is the painter of the image. And the more thoughtful the painter, the greater the understanding he will be able to convey. Incidentally, that contrast between tracing and testify, that contrast I owe to a very interesting author named Gregory Curry, who's written about this and also about fiction and other things. He's an Australian. He writes a lot in England, actually. So it's a very nice contrast. The mirror is a trace. It's just like a shadow, whereas a painting testifies about what is being painted. The painting thus involves composition and interpretation. It also involves a more radical detachment from our present context than mirrors do. A mirror can carry the appearance of a thing some distance away from the thing itself, but it can't go too far. It needs to be close enough to keep its connection with the thing and with what the thing is doing. The mirror continues to reflect the thing in its current conduct. The mirror is immediately wedded to Putin here and now, but the painting is divorced from him, both spatially and informationally. If I were to carry the painting with me from Moscow to New York and were to hang it there on a wall, it would still work as a painting of Putin and his significance. But a mirror taken that far away would be unable to present Putin any longer. Instead, it would give its surface to whatever happened to be around it. Pictures are devoted and permanently committed. Mirrors are promiscuous. Mirrors do not capture what they contain. The appearances contained in mirrors are fugitive. For this reason, we can say that a picture embodies the thing that it depicts, but we ought not to say that a mirror embodies what it reflects. The presence of a thing in a mirror is too fleeting to be called an embodiment. So far I've worked out that contrast between mirrors and pictures. Incidentally, this, bears witness to one of the ideas I like to present, is that philosophy is essentially a matter of making distinctions, that the way it operates is by making distinctions. You play things off against one another and understand each in contrast with the other. And so that's what I've tried to do with mirrors and pictures. And now I come to another subsection. It's not towards the end yet. But the next of these three distinctions, remember I had three: mirrors, pictures, names. So if you want a heading for this part, I'd like to use the advent of names. We bring names into this picture, this context that we've had. So we've examined the interplay between mirrors and pictures, the first two forms of representation in our list, and we've gotten some sense of what appearances are and how they can be moved around. We now turn to the third form, to words or names. Instead of looking at Putin in a mirror or looking at a picture of him, I can pronounce his name. I'll do it right now. Vladimir Putin. And use it in a sentence. What does this sound contain? What does this sound, Vladimir Putin, contain? How does it compare with mirrors and pictures? First of all, the name does somehow contain Vladimir Putin, as well as what he is in a philosophical sense of the word contain. The content of the world, of the word, the thing contained, is Vladimir Putin. In this, it resembles both mirrors and pictures. It is also highly portable, and in this respect, it is like a painting of him. I can use his name in his presence, but I can also use it thousands of miles away, and my speech will still contain him and his significance. But the name differs radically from a picture in that it has no resemblance at all with its target. The image must have some likeness, however attenuated or estranged, to what it depicts. But the word cannot have any such likeness. It must be purely arbitrary. Its being a word does not depend on any similarity with its referent or signification. In fact, the opposite is true. The word necessarily and in principle must be dissimilar to the thing it designates. Any similarity, such as in onomatopoeia, is accidental or decorative, and it does not establish the word as such. It may reinforce the word, but it does not make it to be a word. The word must be non-depictive. It must be, as Husserl said, it must, as Husserl says, have, quote, nothing to do with what it names. Only if the word is so liberated from any bodily similitude with its target can it be free to enter into syntactic composition with other words and permit the expression of true or false statements. Only as so emancipated does it become a purely arbitrary sign, the instrument of our freedom of speech and the sign of our rational responsibility. Names or words must be radically different from mirrored images and pictures if they are to be words and not just sounds that somehow resemble the things that they signify. Thus, I can use the word chirp as a name for the sound a bird makes. And I can make many statements about the bird and the sound that it makes. But if I start repeating the word and gradually begin to sound like a bird, I have, in effect, stopped using it as a name and can no longer place it into linguistic syntax. I can no longer use the sound as a standard part of a sentence. I have begun to imitate or picture a bird, and I am no longer speaking about it. The picturing or mirroring overwhelms the wording. I have lost the kind of detachment that language provides. What then does the word contain of the thing that it designates? You'll see overtones of this, of course, from the Cratylus of Plato. I would say that the word contains primarily the significance of the thing. As we have noted earlier, a painting presents both a thing and its significance, that it's its essence or what it is. We recognize the thing in the painting, and we see what meaning the painter brings out in that thing, what slant he puts on it. The painter may enhance the sense of the thing by what he adds to the painting, the position and stance of the subject, the clothing and demeanor, the other objects of symbolic value included in the composition. The painting presents the subject and shows how the subject should be seen and understood. The name, however, having no visual or acoustic similarity with the thing, just lifts the significance of the thing off the thing and presents it as something simply to be understood, not something to be seen. The picture embodies the thing and its significance. The word captures and carries the significance alone. Words capture and carry specifically the essence of what they designate. They isolate this significance and hold on to it and allow us to join it syntactically with other meanings. Even proper names connote the nature or the significance of the individuals they identify without, however, embodying those individuals as pictures do. So that a man in his office will have a picture of his family, his wife and children, but he wouldn't have a list with their names on it. See, because they're not embodied in the list. I have used the word significance to say what the name captures, but this term might be misleading. It may suggest that when we use the name, we project a linguistic meaning onto the thing we designate. I don't intend to give significance this highly subjective sense. Another word, a better word that could be used as a synonym for significance, is the word intelligibility. A name or a word peels off or lifts off the intelligibility of what it designates. The thing lets its intelligibility be taken by the word, and in such permission, the thing makes the word into a word. We could also say that the name captures the essence or the what it is of the thing being named. Significance does not belong just to words or names. It belongs, first of all, to the things that have it, just as intelligibility and essence do. In fact, intelligibility, significance, meaning, and essence are just four terms for one and the same thing, the what it is of the thing in question. Thus, if the name of a thing succeeds in capturing the thing's meaning, it will have absorbed what belongs first and foremost to the thing that is named. When the name takes on the intelligibility of the thing, it enables us to take in the same eidos in our minds. The intelligibility of the thing is one and the same in the thing and in the word. This is the identity theory of meaning. Intelligibility is not the kind of thing that can be multiplied. There's only one. And it's the same wherever it happens. There can be just one signification. There is not one intelligibility in the thing and another one in the name of the thing or in the minds of those who know it. Nor does the word or the mind contain a copy or a similitude of the intelligibility of the thing. And intelligibility does not permit duplication or multiplication. It is not compatible with many, and it is not something that can be copied. The bodily shape or appearance of a thing can be copied, but not its intelligibility. If our words capture and carry the intelligibility of a thing, they capture the one and the same intelligibility that belongs to the thing, and so they also capture the thing in a way, but not in the manner of mirrors and pictures. The name does not embody the thing as pictures do, and it does not quasi-present the thing perceivable as mirrors do. Then the name is more spiritual and more wispy. It contains only the whatness of the thing, which in olden times was called the form or eidos, the look or species of the thing. One of the same intelligibility, however, is in the thing, in the picture, and in the name. We might use the term meaning or significance to accentuate the intelligibility's presence in the word, but in itself it is the same, quote, content that belongs to the thing. And we don't want to say that the content of the word somehow matches the content of the thing, because this would imply that the former is an entity different from the latter. There is only one content in the thing and in the word, and it is the objective truth of the thing. So all this is a kind of way of formulating the identity theory of the being of things and what is in words and in images as well. But how is this possible? What does it mean to say that one and the same intelligibility is in the thing and in the word? What sort of thing is this intelligibility? What sort of being does it enjoy? I believe that the intelligibility as a principle of being can be made more intuitively understandable as a philosophical notion if we turn back to the phenomenon of pictures. Pictures are intermediate between things and words. It seems intuitively clear to say that a picture somehow contains the thing that it depicts. The picture of Putin certainly somehow contains him. And if it is a thoughtful picture and not just a mugshot, it also contains his intelligibility. You understand him by looking at that picture, if you can read it. It exhibits, or at least claims to exhibit, what he is and how he can be understood. And moreover, the intelligibility is obviously in the picture. That is where we see and understand it. It is embodied there in the image and not just in our minds as we look at the image. Now, something like such picturing takes place in the name, except that it is more ethereal and intellectualized. It whisks the intelligibility off the thing. The name captures just the intelligibility, whereas the picture carries off both the thing and its intelligibility, and it presents them under a particular slant. I am, of course, using metaphors to convey the idea of intellectual abstraction or intellectual taking in. And my metaphors use terms associated with spatial motion. If this sort of achievement, this capture of an intelligibility, can happen in and through a picture, it can also happen in a different way in and through a name. It happens more purely in the name than in the picture, and it's harder to get a handle on it in a name. Also, while we can easily say where the picture is located, it's harder to say where the name can be found. It certainly occurs when it's spoken and heard, where it is written down and read, and where it is imagined, but it also somehow exists in the language, in the cloud of language of which it is a part. The language as such holds many words and meanings in reserve, and spoken words are like condensed droplets in the cloud of language. Above all, we don't want to say that the intelligibility that we take in is just in the mind or in the head. It's not just conceived, not just something mental. To say that it's something purely mental would raise insurmountable obstacles to a proper philosophical formulation of knowledge and being and picturing and speech. The intelligibility we take in is in the name and in the picture. They, in turn, need to be heard or seen as names or pictures, so the intellect must be at work in them to activate them as words or pictures. But the human intellect cannot be at work without its words or pictures, at least in an imagined form. We need words that are at least imagined or whispered to ourselves. We need phantasms within us, and we need pictures and perceived things if we are to be intellectually at work, if our minds are to come alive. We cannot be mindful without them. We cannot think without words and images. And our internalized wording is parasitic on the words we speak with others. Our visual phantasms may be as original as, or even more original than the pictures that we make, but the names we use internally could not come about if others did not teach us language. Speech, with its syntax, brings reason into our internal life and even into the management of our imagination. The words that we use, furthermore, whether in our public or in our imagined speech, exercise a governing role over our other ways of experiencing things. Our verbal intentionalities are more rational than our imaging and perceiving, and they're more under our own deliberate control and even our manipulation. We can use our words to register, explain, and comment on what we see and depict. Speech, logos, is the paradigmatic and quintessential form of intelligence and rationality. Now, at this point, I've kind of concluded my major intermediate section, which is the large part of my talk, mirrors, pictures, and words. And notice how words are the fulcrum here. I mean, pictures are the fulcrum. I like their publicity. I mean, there are pictures on the wall there, and that's where the picture is. The picture is not in my mind. It's on the wall. And just as that picture can carry a meaning, so my words can carry a meaning too. But my words are don't have the embodiment that a picture has. So they're more spiritualized, more purely intellectual. And I can also link them into syntactic holes and speak. So words and pictures are very good to compare and contrast with one another. Now, at this point, I could come to a conclusion, but I have got a little interlude here where I go into a few intermediate forms of representation just to. So this is kind of a relaxed little section. It isn't quite as dense as what I've been talking about. And Vladimir Putin does not make an appearance in this part, but some other forms do. So let's do this as a kind of interlude, and then I'll come to my final part of the paper. Just to fill out our analysis of mirrors, pictures, and words, let's consider a number of forms of manifestation that fall between them. This will be quite quick for each one. A live television report is something like a mirrored image and something like a picture. It's like mirroring because it tracks the thing in its current manifestation, and it involves less of an artist's interpretation than a painting does. It's like a picture because it can be so greatly separated and distanced from its object, so from its subject. So there you have a new kind of representation, which is partly pictorial, partly like a mirror in television. Now, our own imagined recollections, the things we bring up from the past, our daydreams, remembrances, are something like mirrored images because they feed back what has been taken in, but once they are readjusted and recombined, they turned into imaginary compositions. We compose a kind of moving picture of our past. And then they are more like sketches or paintings that we fabricate rather than mirrored reproductions of what we view. Our memories can become like landscapes, portraits, or movies that we compose in order to give accent and intelligibility to our lives. We testify in our memories. Now, let's turn to speech for a minute, for another intermediate phenomenon. Onomatopoeic words, those that mimic the sound or thing that they designate, chirp, buzz, crash, fizz, slurp, snap, crackle, and pop, all come between mirroring and picturing. In their beginning, they merely simulate the sound, but as we invest more of our pronunciation into them, they become more like depictions of what we mean. They become more like testimonies than like traces, and they can subsequently become words when they dilute their similarity with the things and enter into syntax. They're an interesting phenomenon. We started our analysis with mirrors as the most basic kind of representation. There is, however, another kind of representation, the shadow, that is even less substantial than a mirrored image. The shadow. One might hesitate to call it a representation, but Plato does so in The Republic, in his description of the lowest part of the divided line, where he says, quote, "And by images, eikones, I mean first shadows, taskias, then phantasms, phantasmata, in water and in all close-packed, smooth and shiny materials, and things of that sort, as you understand." For Plato, shadows are the most elementary of images. They become before mirrors, mirrored images. They're even more attached to their subject than reflections are. They normally touch the subject at one end and are like an appendage to it. And they present not the full aspect of the thing, but only its shape and motion. The shadow shows up very close to the thing that it shadows, but the thing is much less represented and hence much less re-identifiable in its shadow than in its mirror image. There is less otherness between the thing and its shadow than between the thing and its reflection. The shadow scarcely tells us what the thing is. The shadow is more of an effect of the thing and less its representation. And therefore, less identity occurs between the thing and its shadow. These are rather interesting items in the ontology of appearances. So my phenomenological reflections on shadows, mirrors, pictures, and names are an attempt to reformulate the Aristotelian and scholastic identity theory of cognition, which claims that when we know things, we become cognitively identified with the things that we know. According to this theory, the thing that exists in the real world takes on a cognitive existence in the mind, and it is one and the same thing that takes on both kinds of existence. The soul that has cognitive powers is understood to be a form that's able to assimilate the forms of other things without ceasing to be itself, and it takes them in without changing the known forms into itself. They are possessed by the sense or the mind as other to itself. The things that are known are not, quote, digested into the knower as food is digested into the bodily substance of the living thing that consumes it. The difference between my exposition and the Aristotelian and scholastic one is that I want to expand such cognitional existence and identification to cover external pictures and words as well as sensibility and the mind. The thing known is not just in the mind, but also in the image and in the word. I try to introduce more variety and color, and I try to externalize the mind more thoroughly without losing its embodiment in the person who knows. In particular, I use pictures in a strategic way to bring out the more elusive forms of cognitive existence that occur in names and in the mind. Using pictures and names makes our philosophical analysis more tangible. I wish to recapitulate and enhance the tradition and not replace it, but I also want to explain what it means instead of just restating the usual formulations. The trouble with the usual formulations is that the troped character of words like form and essence is usually overlooked. Such words are assumed to have a rigid scientific significance. Their linkage to their pre-philosophical past is forgotten, and so their poetic character is missed. Now, let me just mention another observation about the style in which I've tried to present these materials. I think it's an Aristotelian way of proceeding. Now, one of the things that's notable in Aristotle is how he will often get at certain phenomena or certain realities by listing several of them and building up to a primary instance. I mean, for example, the three forms of friendship, you know, friendships of pleasure, utility, and perfect friendship. Or the four kinds of moral agents, virtuous, vicious, self-controlled, and weak. The four senses of being that we saw earlier that I mentioned. The three different meanings of ousia. In other words, lists are not merely catalogs when you do them philosophically. You learn about each of the things in the list by contrasting it with the others. And normally, you then also have a paradigmatic instance in that list that explains the rest of them. There's one which is the proshen to which all the others point and are understood. And that's been the sense of mirrors, pictures, and words. I've tried to present it in that spirit or that style. I wouldn't call it a method because that would make it too rigorous. So now, I've got another point, and I hope this isn't overloading. I mean, I've made my major point, but I'd like to show how words function and how to draw a little bit of the value out of what I've developed. I'd like to just conclude with a couple of pages that I can read rather quickly about the three acts of the mind. you know, simple apprehension, judgments, and reasoning. And I'd like to show how words and the things we've said about words work in those three, and how what we've said about it can clarify those three acts of the mind. So this is I've probably talked too long already, but I'd like to add this and then conclude. So we're near the end. So I'd like to contextualize very briefly what I have said about mirrors and pictures, and especially what I've said about words. I want to appeal to a final triplet, to what in classical philosophy was referred to as the three acts of the mind. This is present in Aristotle and is distinguished by Aquinas and by scholastic philosophers. First, the simple apprehension or the grasp of indivisibles. Secondly, the act of judgment with affirmation or denial. And third, the act of reasoning, which encompasses not only rigid syllogisms, but also rhetorical arguments, scientific proof, and dialectical discussion in which inferences are also made. And I would like to reformulate these three acts of the mind in a more linguistic manner. I want to take the first act of the intellect, the simple apprehension, as the act of finding the right word for something, finding the right word. I want to interpret the second act of the mind, the judgment, as a statement, as a sentence that's spoken and formed by syntax. And the third act of the mind, reasoning, as the human conversation taken both locally and also in its widest generality, as what Michael Oakeshott calls the conversation of mankind. Now, when we think philosophically about these three acts of the intellect, we tend to suppose that what we call the first act comes chronologically first, that we collect a number of intellectual forms or species or concepts, and once we have enough of them, we start combining them into judgments and determining whether what we say matches the facts or not. Finally, we graduate into reasoning, where we begin to assemble our judgments into larger compositions such as arguments and proofs. Now, I want to say that this chronological sequence is not how things happen. In fact, the very reverse is what goes on. We begin our rational life by becoming initiated into conversation with others. Our speech moves gradually from extended sounds, from baby talk. Babies begin talking by sentences going up and down. There's a kind of rhythm to them. They don't start with isolated words. Instead, we have a rather rich emotional interaction accompanied by a kind of music, something that at first is something we could call a song without words. We begin with a larger scale interaction and only gradually filter out particular sequences, proto-judgments, and then full judgments, all of which need to be contextualized because they always occur within a larger conversational whole. Then, thirdly, we arrive at the first act of the mind, the simple apprehension. True simple apprehensions, true definitions, are the last thing we come to, the summit of our speech and thinking. This is where the rational mind achieves intelligence, where reason comes to rest in understanding. Simple apprehensions are the mountaintops in the hills and valleys of conversation. Finding the right word, therefore, is the climax of thinking, not the first step. True definitions are the highest achievements of our minds. What I have described in my lecture as the grasp of the intelligibility of things, is not the beginning of thinking, but its climax. And both words and pictures play a role in leading us to such an understanding of things. So, and now, when the right words are found, when an intelligibility is captured, then the character of the other acts, of the judgments and the discourse, the syllogism in the broadest sense, is changed. Now we sense the difference between the essential and the accidental. When we begin, we don't have that difference. We begin speaking highly accidentally, sub quodam confusione, as St. Thomas puts it. We begin speaking loosely, and then we gradually come to understand what things are. That's the apex of thinking, not the beginning. And a sign that we've reached the meaning of words is that suddenly our judgments and our arguments recognize the difference between what is accidental and what is essential, between the definition, the properties, and the accidents of what we're talking about. We don't talk loosely anymore. Our speech becomes thoughtful, coherent, and consistent, and not merely associative and vague or confused. The conversation becomes energetic because we've found the right word for things. And now we can let things show up for what they are. So then a speech becomes truthful. And that's pretty much my conclusion. My paper's gone through mirrors, pictures, and words to show how we capture and carry the essences of things and how they come to light in human conversation and its syntax, which is where human thinking takes place. And I thank you for your attention.